Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Time now for our play-by-play call of the day. And former State College spike Luke Voigt was one of the night's biggest hits.
And it'll be a 3-2. Swung on, a high fly to right. Way back goes Piscotty on the track. At the wall, and is off the wall. In play. Hicks scores. Stanton rounds third. He's coming home. The throw not in time. It's a triple for Voigt. He just missed a three-run home run, but he hit a two-run triple. And the Yankees take a 5-0 lead.
And again, when you get to big playoff games, you don't mess around like Oakland did last night. I mean, Oakland did the analytics thing last night and just got crushed. You know, I've talked about this before. It's worth reiterating again, all right? You go with the guys out there that have been around the block and get it, okay? Here's the Tony La Russa theory on how to take care of a winner-take-all game. You put your best offensive team out there and go from there. If you need to put the defensive guys in later, okay, to put it away, go ahead. Luke Voigt's their best offensive option. They put him at first base. He delivered a big hit last night. That actually is how you handle the game. Bob Melvin is a marvelous manager. Marvelous manager. He's been able to get to the playoffs 5 times in his career. And I think a lot of you don't know that. But Bob Melvin's been there 5 times because he's a really good manager. But he did something last night that I flat out don't get. They won 97 games this year. All credit to them. They're a high strikeout, no stolen base team. They hit home runs. That's what they do. Okay. But he went with this opener and a bullpen night. What? It is not, if Oakland had to go to the last day of the season to get into the playoffs and had to exhaust the rotation to do it, then I completely get it. They had 10 days to set up how they wanted to do this. And as soon as they did that, I was like, you know, because yesterday, remember I had RJ Anderson on yesterday? And I brought that up with RJ. I'm like, you know, you do know that Tampa Bay did this many times this year and they were under 500 doing it. Under 500 with the opener. And remember, Tampa Bay finished over 500 as a team this year. This is not Tampa Bay, well, they were under 500 doing it, but they were under 500 for the year. Oh, no. Tampa Bay finished over 500 this year. They were under 500 when they did the opener. Right? It makes no sense. Just because some analytics guy thinks it's a great idea, tell the analytics guy to go back and start breaking down batting averages, okay? All right? It made no sense what Oakland did last night. None. None. There's certain ways to play that win. Putting your best offensive lineup out there is one of them. It's a theory that Tony La Russa has that I have always endorsed in a winner-take-all game. The Yankees did that last night. And you don't do what Oakland did because you know what? Each guy has exponential pressure on them every inning to be perfect in the inning they're in. Because guess what? That's it. There is no other inning. I felt like I was watching analytics lunacy last night from Oakland. And then I look at a headline this morning. Giancarlo Stanton hits hardest hit homer in postseason history. And it was 443 feet, exit velocity 117 miles an hour. Okay, do you want to know how important that home run was last night? It made it 7-2. All right? Okay, give me important home runs. Bill Mazeroski. Joe Carter. David Freese. David Ortiz. You know, when the Red Sox are losing 5-1 in the bottom of the ninth inning against Detroit in 2013. With the bases loaded, Ortiz put one just barely over the wall in right field. Don't care about apex. Don't care about exit velocity. Do care about where it lands. Okay, that's a big home run. Giancarlo Stanton home run, while in terms of impressive in scope, was not worthy of a headline. That was an analytics headline. Okay? It was the equivalent of the old Bob Uecker joke. I hit a grand slam once. It made the final 13-2. I'm a big believer in as many numbers as possible, but I'm a big, much bigger believer in the feel for the game. Analytics people have no feel for the game. Right? Numbers help you get a feel for the game. I've always been very charitable about giving analytics people credit for giving us as much information as possible, some of it valuable. I do not give them any credit on attempting to how to run a game, how to do a batting order, how to do it. Look, that's why you got that guy over there. Just let him do it. I mean, right now what they're producing are a whole bunch of Dave Kingmans out there. I mean, last night Chris Davis came to the plate, led the majors in home run with 48. Right. Hitting 247. All right. Let's talk a little hockey now. Bob Grove joins us, always dependable, always on time, and the analytics always say he's great. Bob, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Steve, thanks so much for the kind words. It's great to be on with you.
I thought the Bruins put out a heck of a fight last night.
Wow. Talk about not competing in a game. I mean, you know, when it's one of 82, you can always toss it and say, on to the next one, which is exactly what they said because they're in Buffalo tonight to play. But for me, when you have an effort like that, on opening night, that's not a good sign.
At all. All right, so let's get to the Penguins. Part of the, look, this is a marathon. And because it's a marathon, along the way, depth is going to make a difference somewhere. Did the Penguins come out of camp with some semblance of depth, or is it going to be a work in progress?
No, I think their depth is actually better than it was last year.
Yeah.
For me, Steve, going into the playoffs, they had 7 defensemen. They needed 8, and the 7th was Chad Ruedel, and he basically only played when somebody got hurt. In other words, he wasn't capable of challenging for a spot and keeping it. And they got a 24-year-old Finnish defenseman, Juuso Riikola, who's been playing the last 6 years in the Finnish Elite League, who they signed to a 1-year contract, and nobody knew anything about this guy. He came over and he just impressed everybody during the preseason. Now, he's not going to be in the lineup tonight unless Brian Dumoulin is scratched. He was banged up in the last preseason game. Looks like Dumoulin's going to play tonight, but we won't know that till game time. But Riikola is a guy who's already, I mean, it's a limited number of games, but he's moved ahead of Ruedel on the chart. And he actually could challenge for somebody doesn't play well. He might get in there, and it might be tough to get him out. So, and they got Jack Johnson in there this year as well. So I think they're deeper defensively. And then you add Matt Cullen, and you got Derek Brassard, who finally looks like Derek Brassard now in the preseason. I think they're deeper than they were last year.
Let's get to the Jack Johnson part. It's one thing to compete against a guy. Then it's another thing to see what he looks like with your uniform on. What does he do for the Penguins now that he's over with Pittsburgh?
Well, he's going to benefit from playing in an environment that he's never seen before. So you can go back to his days as a King, and then he gets moved to Columbus. And yes, Columbus has had some pretty good teams in recent years, but they still haven't won a playoff series. He's coming to a franchise where he's not this one of the stars. He's not one of the bigger names. He's not one of the alternate captains. He's kind of just another guy. And he's not being asked to put up a bunch of points offensively, which he's capable of. I think the winning atmosphere that he's in is going to help him. I think some of the focus, as I just mentioned, being off of him is going to help him. And yeah, he still has his moments, and everybody knows he's got some of the worst possession numbers ever. He's a guy who sometimes he overthinks things in his own zone. He doesn't make simple plays. He tries to make other plays. He needs to get away from that, but he's good at moving the puck. I mean, he is good at moving the puck. He is a guy who can play physical. I don't think he's played physical enough the last few years. I think he the Penguins could benefit if he'd be a little bit more like that. Right. And he can play special teams. He can play the power play. He can kill penalties. I think he's going to fit in nicely here.
What was it, that old Bull Durham line? Stop thinking you're hurting the club.
yeah, exactly.
I'm going to ask you about, you know, and I mentioned the marathon. What about Casey DeSmith and Tristan Jarry?
Yeah, it's it turned out, I think, the way everyone thought it was going to turn out, which is Tristan Jarry could be sent to the American League without clearing waivers, so that's where he is. And the same would not have been true of Casey DeSmith. And had they tried to send Casey DeSmith down and somebody grabbed him, which I think was probably likely,
yes,
it's okay, you'd say, so what? So Jarry's your backup. Yeah, but the problem is they got John Hughes as the next guy down the line, and he's not a guy who's ready to step in and play some NHL games if you get another injury. So the way that it played out, the way it was supposed to play out, DeSmith was obviously the guy they had more confidence in late last season when they sent Jarry down. They both had their moments in the preseason. Jarry was actually playing better than him until his last appearance when he did not play well in the final preseason game. So, but I really don't think it would have mattered. It wouldn't have mattered if he had pitched a couple shutouts. He was going down to the American League. DeSmith is the backup. He's quite capable. He's a guy who hasn't seen enough time that we can really make any definitive statements about, but he's not out of place playing, serving as a backup goaltender in the National Hockey League.
There's always the and I was referred to this as the uninformed opinion. You can put anybody on Sidney Crosby's line, the guy's going to score. And you and I both know that's a bunch of baloney. So when you look at what they have combination-wise, who, in your opinion, works best with Sid? But then I'll go to the next line. Who works best with Gino?
Yeah. Well, I actually, look, for me, I like the way they've got the line set up again, which is Hornquist back on the top line with Gensel and Crosby. So
perfect. I like the fact that you've got really different styles at all three parts. You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, because Gensel with the speed, Hornquist will dig, Crosby will play make.
Yeah, and I mean Gensel's an absolute. He's a monster around the net. And this kid can score goals like he hasn't done it in the regular season. Oddly enough, he's done it two playoff runs, but not so much in the regular season. So that's an adjustment for him this year. Find some consistency, but that's the point, you know. And then Hornquist can create space for both of them the way he plays along the wall and the way he wins loose pucks. And there are times when you can sense that Sid is a little frustrated because Hornquist maybe can't make a skilled play. Not that Hornquist doesn't have skills, but you know, to start making and plays with Crosby, it's a little bit of a different level. And sometimes Hornquist isn't quite there, but that's okay because he creates space, he wins pucks, he gets them, he goes to the front of the net, he takes away the eyes of goaltenders, etc. So I think that's the best combination for them. I don't really see any. You know, Dominic Simone played some of there last year in the playoffs. Now he's down the lineup on the third line this season, which I think is a much better fit. And then Kessel and Malkin together is the right call.
Yes.
That's the absolute right call. Okay. Now, the caveat there is one of those guys, well, both of them, but there are times when playing defensively is just a complete, total afterthought for both of them at the same time. And those are games when they're a problem.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's what I was referred to in basketball, the guys that are great offensive players that allow as lousy defensive players. They only play defense because the rules tell you you have to.
So, exactly.
Who do you like as the third with them?
Well, he's had an outstanding camp, so he'll be the third line center. I mean, yeah. And so you know that's where he's set with Rust and Simon, and Sprong's going to play down on the fourth line with Cullen and Shea, and Cullen moving from center to the wing because you know the Penguins went out and got Derek Grant from Anaheim, who's been a bit player, but he had his best NHL season last year. So they've got up and down the lineup six centers. Grant won't be in tonight, so they've got all kinds of people who can move around, and Grant can play the wing, you know, when he comes in to play for somebody who is injured. But the way that the lineup's set up now, it's interesting. And you know, Sprong is the interesting piece of it because he did not have a great preseason. He didn't score in the preseason in any of the games, and that's his calling card. And if he can't score, he'll never stick in the National Hockey League. And he didn't have a great camp, but he's in the opening night lineup, and he's on the fourth line, you know, and he's not getting fourth line minutes, I don't think is really going to create much opportunity for him to score. Yes, Shane and Cullen can make plays with him for sure, It's not that they can't, but he's just not going to get a ton of minutes, and he's certainly not going to get much power play time. So, you know, there's a little bit of pressure on Daniel Sprong. He's got to start delivering. He's got to put the puck in the net, period.
I want to get back to the Crosby line for a moment with Hornquist. I know Sid plays the game a little different way than everybody else, but doesn't he see the value of a guy that does all the blue-collar stuff that frees him up to then do what he needs to do?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he does, and he's able to read off him. And, I mean, think about all the years he played with Chris Kunitz.
Yeah.
It's Kunitz and Hornquist, not all that different. You know, I mean, they're really not.
No.
You know, Kunitz was a tremendous guy to win battles and played hard every single night, just like Hornquist does. I mean, Hornquist is – his value to the team is outside of Pittsburgh, nobody really gets how valuable he is because the Penguins just don't have people who play the game like Patrick Hornquist does. He's invaluable on the power play, not only providing screens but picking up garbage and scoring goals, but winning puck battles all over the ice. He's hard to play against, and Sid can read off him. So it's a really good combination.
I mean, let's go back, quote, old-time hockey. He's Wayne Cashman.
Yeah. Yeah, that is old-time hockey. And, you know, when you went into the corners with Wayne Cashman, you better bring your A game or else you're probably going to end up on your butt and he'll have the puck.
I mean, he made Esposito and made Hodge much, much better by playing the same line with him. I mean,
yeah, you know, and he chipped in.
Yeah.
He wasn't a guy that couldn't play. You know, and the same with Hornquist. I mean, Hornquist is never going to get you 40, you know, but he's going to get you 25.
What kind of shape did Kessel come to camp in? And, you know, everyone knows it wasn't his greatest season last year, so sometimes guys dueled something a little bit different in the offseason because of it. Did he?
No, he looks the same as he's always looked, to be honest with you. No, he is. He's a completely different – there's nobody in the NHL like Phil Kessel for me. I mean, he's a little bit of an enigma. You know, he doesn't talk to the media a ton. He's sort of an everyman. Like, he's like, just if you looked at this guy on the street and you said, you know, what does this guy do for a living? You would not say, oh, he looks like a pro hockey player.
Yeah, that's right.
He doesn't look like a pro hockey player. But then you put him out on the ice and that release and everything. And to be, you know, here's the thing. So he didn't have a great playoff. You know, I still think it was an average playoff. I mean, he didn't produce at the levels he had produced the last two cup runs, but his regular season was the best, you know, the best he's had. I mean, so he's coming off a tremendous season where he led the league in power play points, and he looks like the same guy. And if he was upset with, you know, that was the big storyline, that he and Mike Sullivan, the coach, you know, they had a falling out. He wasn't happy that he wasn't playing with Malkin in the playoffs. He was playing with Broussard, and of course, Broussard was hurt, and Broussard wasn't playing well, and, you know, I think it looks to me like it's water under the bridge. He's back playing with Malkin, and I think he's going to have another really, really good year.
Of the moves made in the offseason, you know, Penguins aside, obviously they made a couple moves. What move do you think might be the single most significant any team made during the offseason that you're interested to see how it plays out?
Well, I got to say it's John Tavares going from the island to Toronto.
I had a feeling that's exactly what you're going to say. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, so he's going home. He's a Toronto boy. He's going home to play for the Leafs. And he's sick of not making the playoffs with the New York Islanders, even though he was the face of the franchise. And it was still a tough decision for him. And now he goes into a media market where to say he's under the microscope doesn't even begin to talk about the attention that he's going to bring. But he is a guy who's focused on details. He is a terrific player. And his experience, and you add him and you add Marlowe to guys like Matthews and Marner and these guys, the Leafs are young, the Leafs are fast, they're highly skilled, they have a good goaltender in Freddie Anderson. They are going to be a ton of fun to watch, and I think Tavares is a guy who can take them from being a team that gets in and goes, you know, maybe wins one round, that's it, that now has a chance to make a long run. There are people who believe they're Stanley Cup ready. I don't. I don't think they're good enough defensively to win a cup yet.
Right.
But they could still get to the conference finals.
I thought there was two elements that were missing for Toronto. One was not enough on the blue line, right? And also not enough with their back-checking forwards either. They're so offensive-minded. And number two is leadership. I feel that they solved the leadership problem in a skilled player like Tavares.
Yeah, no, I agree. He absolutely brings that to the table, you know, having been a captain for all these years. So that's the one move that I think has the potential to take a team from, yeah, we're in the playoffs, but, you know, they lost in the first round last season to, again, now they're in the conversation, at least, about being challenging for a cup.
It's been 51 years. All right. So it's a long time for the people of Toronto.
Crazy. And, you know, and that's what people in the States don't understand. There's so many people in Canada who despise the Leafs because,
yes,
you know, they're kind of quote-unquote English-speaking Canada's team, right? So they're just – and they get it's sort of like Dallas Cowboys, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? And so
yes,
there's always so much attention on them and so much talk about them. Even when they're lousy, people just get sick of them. They're like, I don't want Toronto to win. I'm not like that. I think about the fact that the last time Toronto won the Stanley Cup, to your point that you just made, the Penguins weren't even a team when they, you know, they hadn't even hit the ice yet.
Right.
When they won, that's ridiculous. If you're a hockey fan in Toronto, that you have to wait this long to win another cup. So I am absolutely pulling for them to win one soon.
I mean, the Florida Panthers weren't a Stanley Cup final. Okay, the Florida. Okay. I rest my case. Jury vote. That's how tough it's been. All right, Bob. It's always a pleasure. Love talking hockey with you anytime. Thank you for the time.
Same here, Steve.
Tony Knopf coming up next half hour on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Brought to you by Sunbury Motors. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC Way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC Way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC Way. The SMC Way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And it is always great to be with the CEO of InviteManager.com. That is Tony Knopf. Tony, I hope all is well. It's been too long since we've chatted.
Everything's going fantastic. Yeah, I hope things are good for you guys.
It is going really well. I mean, the
sounds
last 8 minutes.
I'm always listening.
Oh, good. That doubles our ratings.
Hey, you were bringing up the last 8 minutes. I wasn't even going to say anything about that.
That's all right, Tony. I had to. You know, it's just that they're that close. Okay. I want to start with the rider, unbeknownst to most of the world. Because of the time of day it took place, the Ryder Cup was being played in the early morning hours in the East in Paris. It did not go well. Number one, what has Tiger Woods meant to a renaissance for the PGA Tour? And I'm going to guess that the corporate partners have taken great notice of his success.
So on the corporate side and on the TV side, it's fantastic, but I'm not sure I'd call it a renaissance because I think people realize that he doesn't have that much longer left in him, right? You know, Tiger shows up when he's a kid and he wins the Masters in 1997, and you're looking at, you know, a possible career. You know, you've got 20 years with this guy. You're lining up sponsorship deals with him like AT&T did and Nike did that are, you know, you're planning on a long-term future with him. You know, the same way people looked at LeBron James when he signed his life deal with Nike.
Right.
This is more of a... The way the PGA Tour and the way the companies are looking at this is, okay, we're going to have this for a very short period of time. We've seen what happened last time he left. How do we leverage this asset to make sure that when he walks away the next time or when he slides down the next time, who's going to be our next star? And that's the number one focus for everybody involved in that sport right now, because what people don't realize is how much of an impact he had. Tiger's impact was so big when he fell off the map that Dick's Sporting Goods almost went out of business just on their golf business going down over 40% in 1 year.
That's
so
right.
he, you know, people say, oh, you know, I want to watch the other golf. The traditional golfer will say, the purist will say, well, they only show Tiger. Yeah, because the ratings are five times what they are without him. So people are tuning in to see. And, you know, it would be unrealistic to think we're getting another decade out of him.
All right, which then brings me to the next part. I think you bring up a really interesting topic I want to explore. That's one thing about the NBA. They've been able to go from Bird and Magic to Jordan, from Jordan to Kobe and Shaq, and Kobe and Shaq to LeBron. All right? In football, they've had that as well. But you and I both know that Brady is almost as old as we are. Well, actually, nobody's as old as I am. But, for the NFL, are you sensing they think Patrick Mahomes is that guy?
So here's what's interesting. It's interesting you talked about this, and we've talked to some sports think tank guys pretty regularly that are, you know, futurists on the sport, and then a lot of guys in sports business who they just know things, right? And they're involved in all of this. And what was really fascinating is you said the NBA went from Larry and Magic to Jordan to Kobe and Shaq. But there was a period in there where the ratings weren't that great, right? The 1993 after he won until he came back in 1997, and Jordan kind of saved everything. And you had the lockout, but then you also had a number of rule changes that really benefited the NBA's aesthetic and the style of play. Right? They looked at it.
They put scoring back in, and they took thuggery out of the game.
Exactly, because you and I remember 1995 and 96. That was terrible. It was Hakeem Olajuwon and a couple of guys shooting threes against Ewing. It was awful basketball to watch.
I mean, and when Charles Smith is considered to be the artist out there, you do have a problem.
Right. And what they did, which was exactly what we were just talking about with Tiger, is they realized what life was like post-Michael Jordan. And they realized all of these flaws that they had that Michael was masking. And Michael left, and then Michael came back. And when Michael came back, they started to change the game in a way that enabled the Kobe and Shaq era to come. And then you had Dwayne Wade, and then you had this next level of superstar. And you know, the NBA has become this global game. At the same time, they're investing heavily in 92, 96, and 2000 in the Olympic Games and just making this an international sport, right? You didn't have the Manu Ginobili's or anything of the world. And, you know, football's done a really great job of, and they haven't done a great job of a lot of things, but they've done a really great job of changing the rules that we all hate it, we bitch and complain about it. But the reality is now you look at this young crop of quarterbacks, you know, the Carson Wentz, Patrick Mahomes, Russell Wilson. You know, this was a position where 3-4 years ago we thought we had a dearth in. And they've changed the game so that it's palatable and it's appetizing. And golf needs to do that too. You know, Tiger's back. You now have him, just like Michael Jordan came back. What are you going to do to make this appealing in the post-Tiger world? And, you know, the FedEx Cup, it is working to make those last couple of tournaments more interesting. People are watching them more just because of the fact that the better players are coming. But they still haven't figured out a playoff picture. Same thing NASCAR has. That they haven't figured out a playoff picture that makes people care down the end, right?
All right. Yeah, well, exactly. That's exactly what the issue that they're running into right now with that. And again, the ability, the NBA did a great job of tonight. It is, let's bring the Patrick Ewing and the New York Knicks versus. It wasn't just the Knicks. They've been able to put the big name on the marquee. They've been able to do that in the NBA. The NFL's been doing more and more of that lately. Now, what is the national anthem issue, which, to the NFL's credit, was dying down and, to their credit, resurrected it? Has that done anything to corporate confidence in the NFL at all?
It does. It's done. It's been a problem in the Midwest and in what some would refer to as the flyover states. But what it's doing is it's cutting into this fan base, and it's cutting into the fan base in a way that it's requiring, it's almost like making people take sides. And some brands are taking sides and saying, look, we're taking the side based on where the customer is, where we believe the customer is going to be. You know, Nike, when they did this advertising agreement with Colin Kaepernick, if you read about it, they actually almost cut that arrangement last year. It came down to a final vote in an executive room where they all talked about it before one guy really stood up and said, we need to do this. And Nike's really looking at us and saying, look, we're gonna ostracize a very large chunk of our customer base. What we are going to do is we're going to empower a large chunk of our customer base who just so happens to be the younger group, and we want that group to come up and have more influence or more... you know, appeal for our brand, which is exactly what they did with Steve Prefontaine, right? Like, nobody remembers that that's how Nike built it. They were edgy back then, and they're getting surrounded by the Under Armours and the, you know, the comeback of Puma and New Balance of the world. And this is a gamble based on numbers. This isn't feel. They're looking at this and saying the demographic that we believe is going to drive the most business for us is going to side with us, you know, in a much bigger, on a much bigger play than they are. We're going to lose business on the higher end demographic or on the older end demographic. And so far with the stock price, it's working. Who knows if that's the way it's going to play out. But you can see that happening in boardrooms. Like, people don't want to talk about it. They never want to bring it up. We don't bring it up. And they're just trying to find a way to get away from it, especially the corporate partners. It is hot potato for them.
Yeah, no, it is a logistical nightmare for them to try and deal with, because, look, you and I both know everybody wants to deal with the hunky-dory world. They don't want to deal with the politics of it.
Oh, 100%. And it's not just that. It's, you know, not every brand is Nike. Not every brand, you know, a lot of brands need to be appealing to the masses, or they just don't want to appeal at all, right? I'm not going to alienate 40% of a customer base, you know, in the hopes that 60% are going to be passionate about my brand. Well, look, Nike built their brand in, you know, if you read Shoe Dog and you do everything about how, you know, he built that brand, he built it around passion. He built it around Prefontaine. He built it around being a little bit alternative, right? You know, Caterpillar's not looking to be alternative. Right, microwave salespeople aren't looking to be alternative. They're selling, you know, commodity. So it's different. So the rules that apply to Nike don't apply to most corporate sponsors. Right, most corporate sponsors are a commoditized business where I would rather just not be involved than have to be involved in a way that makes 60% love me and 40% hate me. And that's why this matters so much. Because other people say all the time, why don't they just handle this by, you know, whatever? There's, you know, 19 different outcomes that they've all studied and they've tried to understand. And the problem is the corporate dollar, more than anything else.
You and I both know that the three major players have been Under Armour, Adidas, Nike. Under Armour split the stock and still went down at one point in price per share. I mean, that's bad when that happens. Now let's get to Adidas, because the trial is underway in New York right now. Mm-hmm. And their names being brought out, their schools being brought out. Now, all of these schools, of course, have corporate partners in other areas besides just the shoe endorsement and the apparel endorsement. Are corporate partners watching this particular trial and the dominoes of it when it deals to universities?
In a sense, I think it's going to have less effect on the universities than people think and on the common fan than people think. You know, what's been interesting about, you know, there's a lot of studies that have been released on this. It's been interesting about, you know, this generation of NBA player, which there's a great write-up yesterday about how it's moving to the European soccer model, right? The players have too much power. Jimmy Butler can just say, you know what, I'm out, right? I got another year on my contract, and I'm going to tell you where I'm going. And that all goes back to Adidas, Nike, Under Armour, and the AAU system that's been prevalent since the mid-90s, right, when George Raveling and Sonny Vaccaro showed up and started throwing shoe money around to kids. So now they don't have loyalty to teams, they have loyalty to brands. And there's a lot of conversations that people don't talk about where it's like, hey, listen, if I as Nike can get Kevin Durant to the Warriors and I can, he'll give up a little bit of salary, but I can subsidize that with money, why wouldn't I do that? Because Under Armour's biggest spokesman is on that team. And by the way, the Chinese brand that just signed another major player to go along with Klay Thompson, they're also at Golden State. Right. So what people don't realize when they're talking about, you know, the power structure that comes from Adidas, Nike, Under Armour, and others, is it's not just at the university level, it's at the NBA level, and it's at the junior level. So I think when this comes out and Louisville gets hammered and a number of teams get crushed by this, and my beloved USC Trojans basketball team, which got crushed by this last year because we cheated everything, when this all comes out, I just don't know if the regular fan's going to care. And I'm not sure that the corporate partner that sponsors the team is going to care that much either, because it's going to be one of those things where it's just so prevalent, right? It's not going to be one school. It's going to be so many that the fan is just going to say, look, it's like the steroid era. Everybody did it. Let's just forget it happened, right?
Well, I'm going to give you the great O.J. Mayo rumor, and I know you know this, but... You know, people say, well, how did he get to USC? And the rumor has always been that he literally called the USC coaching staff the night before and said, I'll be there tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's it.
No, that's not a rumor. They wrote that story's been released. That happened.
Yeah.
It was actually a fax saying, We're going to deliver you O.J. Mayo. He's going to call you tonight at 8 o'clock. And then he did. And the worst part about that was because he came, Gabe Pruitt, Nick Young, and Tops Gibson all left early. And Gibson and, well, I guess Nick Young hasn't been much of a pro, but Gibson turned into a pretty good pro.
All right. Yeah, Taj Gibson's a really good pro. I have to ask you, the NHL, of course, expanded into Vegas last year. They've now started the pathway to get to Seattle. The NBA is going to play a preseason game between Sacramento and Golden State, so Kevin Durant gets to go back where it started in Seattle. What does expansion do for corporate partners, if anything?
Well, here's what's happening, and the sports fan might find this interesting. So Seattle is actually being run by this company called Oak View Group, and the Oak View Group is run by a guy named Tim Leiwicki.
Exactly.
For the common fan at home, what Tim Leiwicki was the guy who built the Staples Center in Los Angeles. He was responsible for kind of the revitalization of downtown L.A., and then they took him to Toronto, and he kind of did the same thing there. So this guy's we're going to build up, you know, downtown districts and the team and everything around it. He's, you know, he's got the ability to do these things. But what Oak View is doing, which is really fascinating, is they're going to these brands and they're saying, listen, we want to sell it. They've created this arena alliance. And what it is it's 28 major arenas across North America. And if you're Walmart, for example, you can now come and buy a sponsorship from them, from Oak View Group. Instead of having to go to all 28 teams and try to negotiate, you can go to Oak View and say, I would like to sponsor 9 of your arena alliance teams. And they've all kind of partnered together. And they're selling these deals, and this sometimes involves club boxes and seats and all of these things. And the common fan says, what the hell do I care about this, right? Why do I care that this is happening? Well, what it's doing is it's enabling teams that are in smaller markets that usually can't compete for that kind of sponsorship dollar to now be at the table. So this actually exists in college, so it's applicable to Penn State. You know, there are two major companies, Learfield, IMG. And what Learfield does is they have 107 universities. And they can go to a brand and they can say, you're looking to expand in Pac-10 country or you're looking to expand in Big Ten country. We represent 7 of the teams. Instead of having to go and try to do deals with all 7, I can get you a deal that has Penn State, Michigan State, and Illinois. And it's enabling these universities now who used to have to try to hire a staff that was going to go out and sell these things and have to fly to New York to get a New York brand to pay attention to actually sit at the table and compete in this arms race with everybody else.
Yeah.
And so Seattle is the first time we're really seeing this in the pros. In college, this has been happening for a while, right? But in the pros, this is the first time we're really seeing, like, okay, this is going to be national interest with corporate brands, and it's going to enable them into that market and other markets. So it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out. I think it's going to be a huge win just because of they've got the model now. They've got the right expansion model. You know, Vegas was competitive in year one, a little bit more competitive than they wanted, but, you know, the team doesn't come in and suck for 5 years, right? So that's the model.
Right. And, in fact, I'll give you an example with Learfield. Learfield put together a multi-network deal because they have all these networks, for example, MyPillow. And so they were able to get sales with MyPillow and put it over several networks, including Penn State.
Exactly. And that's where you see it. And it goes all the way up. Some people think, like, well, that's great for smaller, medium-sized brands, but does that do things for big brands? Next time you see a Nissan sign at a college event, and you will, because they're at 100-plus universities, that's a Learfield deal.
The Nissan opening kickoff, opening tip-off has been on Penn State for years now. Baseball. Last night we watched an analytics game that did not involve the Giants or the Red Sox, so you and I can wear neutral game colors in
time. The Giants are terrible.
I know. I'm sorry. I like to believe it. I enjoyed the conversations much more. The Giants were really good.
The worst.
But it's some people saying that while analytics does a lot of great things, some people saying it's sterilizing the game and it's not helping the game. Okay, now because of what we're seeing, more strikeouts, more walks, more home runs, what is that doing to influence a corporate partner on excitement surrounding the game and getting younger people to watch the game?
Well, so that's the interesting thing about corporate partners is they trail the trend, right? So any trend has an adoption life cycle. Think a standard deviation curve, right? You know, there's trendsetters like Nike's trying to sell to, and then there are, you know, the corporate partners. And the corporate partners are generally a little bit further behind because they're trying to touch a age group, they're trying to touch a fan group. And right. You know, so they know as that fan group's starting to, you know, silo out and they start to move their dollars away. And, you know, the analytics phase, it affects a number of different things, and that's where the sports need to be able to adapt to it. And I'll give an example. Football has been an analytics-based business now for the last 10 years. You know, the days of Corey Martin or Corey Dillon being the running back for your team for 10 years are long over. Yeah, the days of, you know, Curtis Martin being the same tailback for 9 years, that's long over. You have a tailback for 2 years, and that's it. So you have to find another way for that person to acclimate to the brand, understand the game, and find an exciting game. And now baseball has that problem because, one, you know, the lifetime of a major leaguer is shortening as far as being an all-star and being a superstar, right? We're seeing it move into a younger game. But also, you know, as the game becomes more analytics-based and you don't have those faces that you grew up with and there's so much free agent movement, the millennials don't watch it. And attendance was down. They released 2 days ago that attendance was down 5% this year across the league. That is a staggering number.
That's
when
gigantic.
You're talking about in a 10-year bull run. Can you imagine what the decline would be if we were in a recession? Right? So you're in a situation where you have the best economic environment possible for your sport to grow, and you drop 5%. That is astoundingly bad. And so what that means for corporate partners is they see all of these numbers on a regular basis. Most corporate sponsors and partners are analytics-driven themselves. And they sit down and say, who goes to the game? Who am I trying to sell to? And listen, there are sports that try to sell to older, affluent people. Golf, for example. You watch golf, you see ads for Tiffany, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, things that you're not going to see when you're watching, you know, e-gaming or an e-sports game or a major league soccer game or whatever.
Yeah, lots of life insurance, yeah.
Life insurance, you know, financial planning, wealth management. You see, you know, the Pacific Life whale over and over again. Schwab sponsors the Cup, you know, all that stuff. And that's what they're looking for, right? They're trying to sell to you and I. Well, yeah, okay. Yeah. I think about those things. You know, all those people are welcome on my lawn. But when you're talking about baseball, you know, baseball is starting to turn into this sport that is a, you know, it is an older generation watching it. And that's okay for golf because it's always been that way. But baseball has not always been that way. And the economic pressures that are in place and the economic spending that is in place is around it being a major sport that is mainstream. And as that slides, you know, people think, oh, baseball's never going to, you know, slide away. I saw Bob Bowman speak, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and he was talking about how baseball, even though people were talking about its demise, was, you know, in 1950-something, the three largest sports in the world were boxing, horse racing, and baseball. And baseball's still here. And I thought, that's a terrible way to look at this. Like, that should frighten you, because it's not just about baseball's growth numbers or its falling numbers. It's about any of us who are old enough remember that baseball ruled the day before 1994. We weren't talking about the NFL and the NBA as competitors to it. And now almost anybody would say, oh, the NFL's three times the size of baseball.
Right. Exactly.
You know, that's a trend that's been happening for three decades.
Exactly. You know that this conversation could be easy for 3 hours, right?
This is the part I look forward to. This is a fun stuff.
I find this all fascinating. So, and I'm glad you're listening. I'll tell Jack. Jack and I always wonder who we're reaching. I said, "Yeah, we got Tony Knopf." See, that's
big
time.
Got it. Yeah, I listen online.
I appreciate that. Tony, it's always a pleasure, my friend. Thanks so much. Hopefully we'll do this again soon. This was too long in between talks.
Yeah, next time we're going to talk about the corporate impact of CFP going to 8 teams. Because you're telling me that one play is the difference between Ohio State and Penn State at the end of the season? It's not.